Any rhinoplasty is a preservation rhinoplasty, unless you are a clumsy surgeon. You know, you try to preserve the mucosa, you try to preserve the valve areas, you try to preserve the cartilage as much as you can, the soft tissue. Otherwise, you're not a good surgeon.
Mm. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Rhinoplasty Podcast, Season 3, where we're doing face-to-face interviews. And we're coming to you from Brussels, the European Rhinoplasty course. And I've got a man on today's podcast who is somebody I have been trying to interview for 3 years, but it is so difficult to get hold of, Professor Hossam Foda. And finally, I've got to be at Brussels and we can have a chat. Hossam, it's great to see you again. And thank you for being on this episode.
It is my pleasure, Cameron. It's my pleasure.
So, Hossam, the first time I met you, it was actually when I was with Russ Cradell in Houston, and I saw your picture and I thought, oh, there's another African guy who's crazy like Moses. And I mean, you did a fellowship with him.
Yeah, that was 1990.
1990. Goodness.
The 33 years ago.
So tell the listeners about your journey in rhinoplasty. How did this guy from Africa end up in Houston and now end up being one of the doyens of rhinoplasty globe?
I tell you how it started. When I come from an ENT background. So I finished my residency in ENT and all my practice was head and neck surgery.
Mm-hmm.
I love to do head and neck surgery because it makes you feel like a real surgeon, you know, removing larynx, doing pull-ups, doing radical neck dissections, thyroid. Makes you not working through a hole in the ear and, you know, with a microscope and that's it. So at the end, you know, these are all cancer patients, so they have complications.
Yeah.
So you enter the department every day, you're surrounded by like 10 people, everyone has a complication. This one got a fistula, this one's not swallowing, this one has a problem with the probox, there is a stoma recurrence, there is an irradiation problem. And they're all very depressing, you know? So I decided when I shifted into my doctorate degree, I said I would choose a branch where I would operate on a patient. The patient will be happy.
Yes.
He'll meet me somewhere, hug me, send me a thank you note. You know, I want to change my life. So I chose the facial plastic as the subject for my doctorate degree thesis. And the nearest thing to ENT was the nose.
Yes.
I won't do a MD thesis on facelifts or air. So I chose the nose. At that time, there were a few eminent rhinoplasty surgeons who come from ENT background. So it was like Tony Bone in London. It was like Goodman in Canada. I was actually communicating with William Wright in Houston. He was the professor of Russell Cradell.
Okay.
But at that time, he retired, and Russell Cradell was in charge of the practice.
Yeah.
So the quickest communication came from Tony Bull and from Russell Cradell. And at that time, Tony Bull was doing only closed, and Russell Cradell was doing open rhinoplasty, because William K. Wright was a pioneer in the open approach. So I chose to go to Russ, and that was 1990. It went very smooth, and I went there and stayed for a couple of years. I did my doctorate degree thesis, which was about 250 rhinoplasties, analyzing the open approach.
Yeah.
And I had to go back to Egypt to defend my thesis, which I did. And I became appointed as a lecturer in my department.
Yeah.
At that stage, I decided to do only facial plastics, no more ENT. So I started a subdivision in my department, which is a facial plastic surgery subdivision in the ENT department.
Okay.
It was the first among all the Egyptian universities.
Wow.
We have like 20 universities in Egypt. None of them have a subdivision of facial plastic.
No university in Africa had something. Never mind.
No one had this. And it was a big fight with the general plastic surgery department. You know, there are hardliners and how come facial plastic will go to the ENT and blah, blah, blah. But I was very well protected by my professors in my department because they know I'm very well trained.
And your PhD.
And they know I'm very well trained. They don't want any complications, you know. So I started doing everything in facial plastic. I did hair, I did facelifts, I did blepharoplasties, I did microtia repairs, I did everything in facial plastic. Mm. And then the residents came to rotate in my unit in every 3 months. Whoever is interested in facial plastic will stay in the facial plastic division. So the division started getting bigger and bigger. So I supervised MD and PhD thesis on facelifts, on nasal reconstruction with flaps, on many subjects.
Yeah.
And everyone will sub-specialize in something in facial plastic. So they are now covering everything and I'm not doing anything in the department anymore. Yeah, but it was a nice journey. I'm not regretting it at all.
But now you're in private practice.
I'm in private practice since day one, because in Egypt, you can be a full-time professor and have your private clinic.
Okay.
So in the afternoon, you can have your private clinic and operate on your private cases and everything.
Okay.
Because they don't pay you in the university a big salary. No. It's a very small salary at the university. But you get the position and the residence and the facilities that you need for research and everything.
But you have two private practices. Not like it's, you love traveling and you're traveling all over the world. But you also got some that say to even travel within Egypt.
I travel within Egypt every week because I have a practice in Cairo and a practice in Alexandria.
Yeah.
So the first 3 days, which is Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, I'm in Alexandria. And then Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, I'm in Cairo every week.
Yeah.
Unless I'm out of the country. And I have another practice in Dubai, another practice in Kuwait. So I travel a lot.
Wow. And
I'm enjoying you in South Africa.
I know you've come and we hope next year for World Rhino Plast Day we'll get you out there again to watch, to come and see things. And so like this is a career of like 40 years plus. This new resurgent wave of preservation rhinoplasty. What are some of your thoughts around it?
Actually, I have seen lots of things come and go. Let's put it that way.
Mm.
Even in the piezo, I was among the first, let's say, expert group that they chose, the company chose to design the inserts and do the research on the piezo. That was maybe 15 years ago. It was Olivier, me, and Rick Davis, and Henri Corobotti, and Barry Shaker, and Gotsil, and these are people I actually remember. Henri Corobotti showed a slide about that group. And I stayed working with piezo for a while, and I didn't find that it's giving me a major advantage to keep doing everything using the piezo. You know, even for a lateral osteotomy, it takes a longer time. For a small hump, it takes a longer time. And it's not adding a big benefit. For me to shift, I have to have a major advantage in order to shift. But if I can do the thing in a different way, in a more simple and faster, I would stay doing what I'm doing.
Yeah.
It's a preservation, which is your question.
Yeah.
I skipped that. The preservation has been there for hundreds of years.
Mm.
And people stopped the preservation because of the incidence of complication and hump recurrence and step deformities and blah, blah. Now the techniques has been refined considerably.
Yes.
By using it became more precise, it became more accurate, it became more doing it through an open approach, you know. So many, many things made the complications less and less. But what I'm against is the term preservation.
Mm.
That's my only concern because every rhinoplasty is a preservation rhinoplasty unless you are a clumsy surgeon. You know, you try to preserve the mucosa, you try to preserve the valve here is you try to preserve the cartilage as much as you can, the soft tissue. Otherwise, you're not a good surgeon.
Mm.
But the term preservation, if you're not doing preservation, you're doing a destructive rhinoplasty. No, it's not true.
Yeah,
it's not true.
Yeah, because it almost it's to say like my way is the only way.
Yeah.
But it's not necessary.
And people are still getting excellent results without any preservation.
Yeah.
What does a preservation preserve? Preserves the junction of the upper laterals with the dorsal papillary septum at the keystone area. Other than that, it is destroying everything else.
Sure.
Like the bones, like the septum, like the everything.
Okay, last question before we go to our last session is, you're obviously teaching all over the world at different conferences, but if somebody wants to come and learn from you, is there a possibility that people can actually come to Cairo or Alexandria and learn? Do you run any courses or anything like that?
Actually, I get visiting surgeons from everywhere, but I have my own fellowship, which is a unique fellowship. It's a hands-on life surgery fellowship. So it's for a limited number of surgeons, and they come and scrub. And my role is to instruct them on what to do and what not to do. So they are working with their own hands.
Wow.
Whatever I do on the right side, they get to do on the left side. So we do like 14 cases in 1 week, and they will get a consideration.
And have you had some long-term follow-up on those patients to see which side you operate?
I will never make the anesthetist wake up the patient if I'm not totally satisfied with the result.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, awesome. It's great to chat to you. Thank you so much. Thank you for what you do for the world of rhinoplasty. And I hope you have a great year.
I would like to compliment one thing, your energy and enthusiasm for rhinoplasty, because that's something which is so evident for everyone.
Yeah. It's great. Thanks. Guys, thank you so much for tuning into this episode of the Rhinoplasty Podcast. Make sure that you're back next week for our next episode.